It doesn't matter. It absolutely doesn't matter. You can just, you know.
Just let it roll.
Is it rolling? Exactly.
It's rolling. Okay. The numbers are moving.
Okay.
Right, so I'll take two, yeah. Rewind.
The levels were fine.
Okay. So we're going to read through this text and we're going to discuss it, are we not? And maybe we'll try and do an abridged version. So this is Taylor's text, A Question of Liminality, Ecosonic Negotiations of Improvisation Interaction. After walking around and listening to improvisation in different locations for a while, I am sitting between two musicians, a cellist and a Nye flute player. I am sitting very close to them. I am actually sensing their playing more than listening to it. Suddenly, I feel that I have to be sonic too, and I generate a long hissing exhalation. What actually I am supposed to be doing, however, is observing the improvisation of the Ecosonic Ensemble, London, UK. But what happened to the decent distance between those being observed and the observer? This is the last of the three themes upon which I will reflect, and I will focus on the interaction at the liminal stages of the Ecosonic improvisation. The two other issues explored are acoustic and electronic sound production in the context of listening, looking and touching, and the baroque flute and Nye flute playing as the socio-material controlling of the air. So, what did we say?
Liminality was the first thing that came up, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Mm.
I think I asked you how it felt to have Seth reading your text.
Yeah.
And I was saying it's a bit like a poetry reading group. Or
yeah, and your questioning of the... using this
Victor Turner,
yeah, it's semantic trap.
Oh, yeah.
And naming, yeah, we had a big thing about.
Yeah.
So there was something about, liminality. Why are we referencing liminality?
Mm-hmm.
The idea of
state changes,
yeah,
discrete
versus cruddy. Yeah.
Could there be a discrete, or could there be a continuous
a
state change?
Yeah.
Or,
no,
that
you said.
No,
yes, no.
No, they could not.
Most definitely.
In my understanding of the idea of liminality, that led on to, though, your observations about the state changes within the machine and within the computational decisions and the programming issues, which kind of supports then this apparent freedom at the top.
Yeah, the political issues of making decisions about that.
There was something about this process, wasn't there? You said something,
yeah.
There was something about...
this hypertext recording. We were talking about, even before we read the text, the way that it could be part of a future document and including the recordings and including hypertext sort of
combined
links from one person's text to another.
Yeah.
Oh, no, my question was whether there's a parallel in the Ouija board...
Mm-hmm.
The way that the sonic identity coming from using the Ouija board, which differs from the kind of sonic identity of acoustic performers, I wondered if there was something similar in dialogue, because it always seems as if when you're speaking, it's always you.
Mm.
And of course the text...
That's really... I didn't get that the first time round, so...
I think I perhaps didn't use the word dialogue so clearly.
Mm-hmm.
No, the dialogue is always you speaking.
Yeah.
But the moment we talk about pooling a text, I think we have similar issues about how to understand it and contextualise it that we do when we're talking about the kind of operations of using that.
So locating the idea of voice for multiple voices.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Multiple voices.
Mm.
Let's underline multiple voices.
Yeah, and the question about, I suppose, that's a whole other. There was another thing about, what else did we talk about? There was something about, the observer and the observed, but we decided that was maybe didn't need to be commented on.
We said that was taken as a
given. Taken as a given that to
observe
is to change what is being observed,
yeah.
and there's always an implication of the observer in the, there's no... objective.
I mean, I think that there's a slight kind of thing that, thinking about it in an anthropological sense, you're doing field work, but this is a performance. You're always performing. We're not always performing because we do perform on our own, but it is a performance, therefore.
This participative observer that we have here.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
We didn't talk about that, though.
Well,
no,
I definitely, it definitely came, it was about to come up.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
just predictive.
Yeah.
Just, it was about to come up before we checked it, because...
It's that future retro-causality.
It's a future retro-causality, because it's precisely the thing of being able to see your trace on the sheet, which gives you this strange feeling of being an observer of the thing that's actually creating the sound.
Mm-hmm.
So in some way I felt that was a link to your... notion of
yourself. We're now
getting
ahead of where we were, though.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So let's. So it's
were there other were there other main points that there were from that first part of the discussion then? Before Kirsten, there was. It was a lot about liminality, wasn't it?
Yes.
Really about liminality
yeah.
and the construct validity almost of whether it was applicable here or not. And you gave a very good explanation as to why. There was a conversation between you two about its relevance, and I'm just trying to.
Well, I think
so
you saw it very much within that kind of ritual,
anthropological
and medical sort of context, and I think we saw it slightly differently.
Yeah.
Well.
Oh, liminal liminoid.
Liminoid, which is, I mean, Victor Turner makes that distinction, doesn't he?
But doesn't often get taken up.
No, well, that's what I found interesting, that most of the discussions went that you hear talking about kind of art or aesthetics in terms of liminality, people always just sort of say the liminal, and they always refer to Victor Turner, but never quite...
Because I haven't read the primary text.
Is that why? I don't know.
I don't know.
I wasn't quite sure.
A bit.
They always use the same quote, though, from Victor Turner.
Yeah,
it's always
well,
kind of like
yeah,
the same
yeah.
things come up, but... But yeah, I think that distinction does need to be made.
So we kind of agreed that we would want to use the term liminal in quite a specific and refined
yeah.
way rather than in a more... Because
yeah.
it can be rather over-inclusive.
It can, yeah, and I think you do need to, to make
it. You're talking about the textual links, with whether it was because of the word
Ouija.
Oh,
Ouija,
yes. Well, that's where we got into
the
naming
thing.
Yes,
the
naming.
Yes,
naming.
And the trap
yeah.
that can have.
So the idea of a semantic... Right, because of the name Ouija.
Yeah.
Because we use
yeah.
Ouija, does that imply?
Because you felt that
ritual?
Really did kind of bring out the ritual side.
Well,
of
it somehow underlined it or
emphasized
it or brought
yeah.
it,
yeah.
and then there was a conversation about Hebbian networks. So I was saying something about associations. That word, if by naming it, you create a conceptual
yeah.
field,
yeah,
which
yeah.
then
Absolutely.
Brings with it associations and activates some things which are conscious, some things which are not.
Well, I think you do, obviously, but that's what happened.
Yeah.
That's kind of inevitable.
Was,
and
yeah.
if you didn't have that, you would have nothing. Again, it's
and you would still. Create some kind of space without
yeah.
naming something.
Yeah.
I would say.
Through other means. And then it would be unspoken as well.
Because how could you speak without conceptualizing?
Yeah.
How could you produce knowledge, for example, or something?
Big topic there.
Yeah.
Huge, that is. Is there something that exists outside language?
Yes, there is, but... it's not an
it's
not somehow neutral or kind of I don't think well we this was the huge thing that we had in our dialogue in
I
the,
find
this
it interesting
discussion.
That if the naming is the kind of the act of naming, what's the problem with the act of naming?
Well, I think it's no more I don't think it's any more of a trap or of a thing a curtailing than other types of knowledge are. They all they all do set up some kind of boundaries.
They all
around.
Do, but I don't think they're on an equal footing. I think that's probably what I was trying to say.
And do you feel then that the language is dominating?
I don't have a problem
no.
with that, because I think
yes.
I like the idea, that I like the fact that it's called a Ouija. And
yeah.
like
I was
going to
say, you've been the one
channeling.
That's actually kind of...
Yeah, no, I'm not being... I mean, I'm just raising it as a,
yeah,
as a
as
question.
Issue, yeah.
It's not that I don't like it or that I want to change it or that I'm being critical. It's just that...
It's
present.
It's there.
Yeah.
And I think
well.
At that point, I wanted to. I made the point that something about that it operates by a metaphor, so that the metaphors of light and obscurity and
the shadow,
and
the enlightenment thing,
and the enlightenment.
Yeah.
Do you throw us back into the dark ages?
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's. It's not only a metaphor; it's an actual
operating
principle.
System.
Yeah. So it stands against this. This drive for clarity and refinement and standardisation and all that stuff.
Mm.
problematizes.
Well, it represents it and also shows you not a rational frame around it, but kind of the hints at all the other things.
But I still keep asking that, is the act of naming, does it have some special political connotations to author this kind of power, this kind of authorizing meanings from very specific positions? So is the naming, the act of naming, problem in that sense that it kind of makes visible your position as an author, as an knowledge producer, and kind of that you, if you mean that it could be better to, because I see that, for example, using the theoretical frame of liminality, kind of metaphorical sense, is choice what is done now, but it could be another theoretical concept also. It's not kind of that I want to fix that the Uicha should be spoken only in terms of, for example, it's only one choice, it's like a one experience, I look, it's kind of, perspective. And I find it interesting if the act of naming is a problem, because if we think the sonic interaction, you make a sound. In a sense, you could say that you are naming sonic textures when you are making sounds, but they are.
I'm only naming them when I'm trying to describe them. If I'm trying to attach verbal descriptors to the sound, spectral morphologies, whatever, Smoothie-esque moment, in a sense, I'm engaged in naming. Otherwise, my take on what you say is to say that there's something, I mean, again, horribly jargonistic, but there's something more ontological about the sounding itself, the being in the sound, as opposed to. That's another conversation, isn't it?
Yeah, but the sounding itself, it always kind of, it refers to this kind of music itself. I mean,
an idealization of some sort.
Yeah, autonomously aesthetic. In a way, because I mean, if you hear a sound, could you hear a sound kind of?
I was going to say it's actually an acoustic thing again.
It's always going to be environmentally.
And you are kind of naming it, whether you are not saying it aloud.
But by naming it, I bring it into being in the sense that I bring it into my conscious awareness. I become conscious of it because I name it as an entity which stands out from the general thing.
But I'm sure you are not naming it when you are listening to it.
I think we're probably permitted to go off. I mean, I've got.
There were lots of things that I wanted to recapture from the, after the when you did your. There were things there that we.
Just before we recapture that bit, there's a. Well, at that point when we were talking about names, Tina said, "You know, you're talking about the names of the group as well."
That's one thing.
Yeah. And then.
What was the relationship between the instrument and its name, and the group and its name?
Yeah. Mm. And the group interaction and its name.
Mm. And the significance of the name.
Yeah.
And then I also was saying that the discussion about why are we talking about the Ouija when it's really about the people. At some point, I can't remember what we said. Or not. That sounds maybe
all well, curious. There was also that discussion about the ownership of the instruments. Did we recap that before the leaning on the instrument?
Oh, yes. The kinesthetic control.
When you're centered.
But even in this bit, I was saying that I felt that there was a relationship between the individual people and how they might use the Ouija board as a sort of, either as a reflecting surface so that you can see a position that you have in relation to it, or that it's something, it's serving a useful purpose. It's not an actual object, but by treating it as an object, it achieves a certain kind of function for us who are not strictly playing it, that it rather like an icon, you know, that it's not the actual thing, that's
it's an iconic relationship rather than a what's it, C.S. Pierce, all that business about
index,
and that its apparent neutrality allows us to kind of exploit it, but the fact that we name it is not a rational thing you know, it's not really nameable, but it's useful. Yes, it serves a useful purpose for us.
Mm.
Maybe I didn't say it like that. That's a thought.
Yeah, then this democratic instrument of Ouija.
The democratic, yeah, the independent democratic nation state.
Yeah, notional democracy.
That was next, though, wasn't it? Was
okay,
the
okay,
next
so,
page.
Right,
next,
yeah.
So next came. Should we move on? Was it? Was
next
it? Was,
have,
yeah,
I think
so
that's.
Yeah, then there was. So it's Kirsten.
Okay. Touching by seeing, listening by touching. Rubbing, scratching, stroking, shaking, tapping, knocking, and the noise of a train gliding smoothly into sonic space, without the immediate sense of touching, or so it may seem. In this sound example, there are five players, three acoustic instrumentalists, Stephen Preston, baroque flute, Seth Ayaz, nigh flute, daft drum, and Thomas Gardner, cello, and two Ouija board players, Kirsten Edwards and Peter Coit. According to its developer, Thomas Gardner, the Ouija is a group musical instrument that acts as a bridge between acousmatic and instrumental vocal techniques. Based on the real-time video analysis of the shadows of a group of people, it reframes many of the conventions of the traditional tactile instrumental control. The tactile quality of acoustic instruments is in contrast to this remote, shadowy form of engagement. The train noise in the sound example is played through this shadowy form of engagement by moving hands above a white sheet. But how actually does this non-touching interact with the tactile actions of acoustic instrumentalists in the sound and meaning production processes?
It's also nice because you read it differently. I mean, Seth read it differently now, second time, and you too.
Yes.
You too.
Yes. Yeah.
It's kind of process all the time. Yeah.
I do find this quite interesting, that thing. I know we've talked about it again, but the relationship between the non-touching and the tactile instruments, I think.
Self-absorbing. Yeah, and then we ended to discuss about this kinesthetic control, which still is with Ouija, and then these differences between. You had a very good point of the playing theremin and.
Yeah. Well, it's the difference between the theremin doesn't have. Well, it is limited.
Mm-hmm.
The actual sound you can make. Your gesture has an impact, but the sounding.
You can't see it on the object.
You can't see it on the object, but also you can only make the sounds you can make. Can only ever be from the electromagnetic thing. It is limited to that, isn't it? But this is quite a straightforward thing. But it does affect how you even gesturally try to engage with something, that you're always thinking about the sound that will be there, that you will be shaping, and that you will be. That changes all the time. That will be constantly changing. There's no consistent. Underlying sound that you would have with an acoustic instrument, or with the, to a certain extent, I think with the theremin. There's always an unpredictability of the sound you will be shaping, and how you attempt to shape it will be informed by what you think is going to be there.
So do you mean that there's an unpredictability of the sound producing mechanism, or both
because obviously whatever is there will, the way that your gesture relates to it is going to be, and shapes it will be different, because it has a different
predictability is a degree of
not just predictability, but whatever kind of whatever sounds have been put into it will be shaped differently by any gesture. There's no consistent sound or potential sound to be shaped. It's always changing.
Yeah.
There
are
some landmarks, though.
Well, obviously the
FFT analysis.
Yes, though, you're right.
There are some points of.
Well,
yeah,
we've made them.
Stability. Yes,
it's
made
our.
Yeah.
Sort
but even so, those come from they don't come independently, they come from the sounds that are being given to it, don't they? They're not, there's no standard that you...
I'm sorry, I went into a moment of tricky hyperspace, whether I was trying to engage with a re-remembered conversation or whether it's a new one.
I'm having the same difficulty.
It acted as a slight barrier because I was trying to think, am I summarising?
Which way are
sorry,
you?
No,
yeah.
I have to deal with this. I'm sorry.
I'm really sorry.
Yes. How would you, Kirsten, describe the difference between playing Ouija when you are playing these pre-recorded files and when you are playing the acoustic instrumentalist's input?
The difference?
Yeah, the difference.
Obviously there's that thing of the communicative interaction side of the players, and that you're very attentive then to what is it happening in real time of the moment, where you're not so much with the recorded files, but you're still then always kind of, the recorded files are still in relation to the sounds, but there is less of a slightly less. They are more consistent to a certain extent, aren't they? They're kind of always there.
Mm.
So you're not quite so kind of immediately conversing with what's happening.
But would you describe more the quality of the consistency? What, how does it affect your kind of playing?
Well, there is a thing, because the real time, not the real time, the recording samples are playing continuously, so you never know at which point you're going to access them.
Mm-hmm.
So again, there is still that. So that.
Oh yeah.
It's the silent. They're silent.
Loop.
But looping.
Yeah.
So
that's something you can't know how, to a certain extent, how your gesture, what will.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, you have even less knowledge of that than you do if you're kind of working with the samples from the real time sampling from the acoustic things. You actually are responding quite directly to what you have heard, or
but
to
that's at the moment when it goes from silence to being audible, but the moment it becomes audible,
there's a difference between those. Yes, you are then not leaping into the unknown, you're kind of working to a little bit with what you. So there is a difference between something which is completely unpredictable and something which you're responding to through with knowledge.
And also on that point, that was something else that I was going to say about this bit of text, of a train, the recording of a train driving into a station,
Yes.
I mean, they're all things, but that they were recordings that Peter had of his visit to Austria, which is where we were going to go to do the performance.
Oh, yeah.
And there were also recordings of his journeys into the ancient civilizations of, pre-Germanic tribes.
And again, that's quite interesting, that everybody has a different... The people who made those recordings have a
and it's precisely...
I mean,
that's
that, why we
that,
like
that exactly,
idea,
that's the whole idea is that it's...
Have.
He made the recording, we know what it's about, we know more significances than might be apparent only from the sound of it.
The snippet that you
didn't open by touching. Yeah. So you knew, I mean, everybody told about these pre-recorded things were.
And that it was, that it's some, that's, it has another level, another set of meanings, which is to do with his actual journey there that happened, and him embodied there with us and bringing the sounds back, so that it is, although there's a kind of element of it not being here in the present, it's nonetheless in the lived experience.
Mm-hmm. They tried another way, that not to introduce the themes of the pre-recorded files, the sound files, just to put them into Ouija and then to play, and nobody knows.
So only the person who did the recording
knows. Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's happened to me partly just because I've been missing and then come back and I've not been there for the discussion, so that I have been in that situation where they, so you're literally just hearing them in a cold.
Well, I think that we haven't really, I mean, I feel it's something that's happened. I mean, I feel that the experience of hearing sound files, the idea of bigger relationships to them than to abstract kind of material, that there is this idea of them being known, and the kind of that the subjective relationship to the recording isn't exclusively between, you know, the person who made it and the sounds, but it's somehow their presence allows us to look at them whilst the sounds are being played, and that you feel their response in some sort of homeopathic or counterintuitive, or, you know, so like there is some kind of process of referral between people.
I think there is for me. I remember one incident moment when the sound files that came up were the ones that I'd recorded in Morocco, and there was some azan and there was some various things happening, and that directly influenced my choice of instrument, which presumably had a second impact on what other people. So that was very real in some way, that you know, I was referring to specifically my
experience
in some way of being there. But whether that's always true.
No, is that the way it works? Might be very unpredictable.
Again, it's always going to depend on the context you're in, isn't it? And how much you're responding to the space, the here and now space,
and how
you hear what you've done from the past will be different each time, won't it?
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, and now when you said how you hear or how you listen to, because I like this Jean-Luc Nansis, because he said that there's always in the senses this listening to hearing seeing,
yeah,
looking, these pairings which are the different modes of activity or approach.
Should we read that part of the text? Have you done that already? Have you got
no,
something?
We haven't.
That's
paragraph.
The next bit of the conversation.
Is that now Thomas's falsetto part?
Yes.
Right, so whatever is unspoken from the previous paragraph remains unspoken. We won't talk about what we said.
Were there other things that you can think of then that were...
I think there was a whole discussion about the shared territory of the space which the Ouija board is.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, which is something that I wanted...
The democratic state.
Yes, exactly. And I really wanted to find out what... I feel that that's an area that I want to talk about more.
Mm-hmm.
Should we do that?
Through which we can, which will come up later.
Yeah, later.
Yeah. Ouija players look at their hands and the shadows the hands create. At the same time, in a very sensible interplay, they listen to the sound the hand movements generate, which is produced to some extent by acoustic players touching their instruments to make the sound. If to listen is tendre l'oreille, to stretch the ear, as Jean-Luc Nancy suggests in his book Listening, could the stretching of the ears of the Ouija players be their looking at their own moving hands and the shadows generated? Could the listening be the intensified looking at visual, oral, resonant meanings with shadowy edges? Consequently, could that looking be touching, precisely because of its intensive contact with the hand that touches, in quotes, the sheet through the shadow making. The generation and interpretation of the shadows involve a tactile sensitiveness that is similar to touching. Playing through controlling the shadow's organic spatial variations produces a particular kind of the hand-instrument sound relation. The close interconnection between looking and touching in Ouija playing produces a very specific continuities between these senses. It is not a question of the sense of sight or the sense of touch, but rather a matter of plural relations between the senses.
Mm-hmm. My immediate take to that was something about surely all sensory experience is polymodal. So I agree that there is no the sense of touch, mm-hmm. the sense, you know, that all experience maybe has an emphasis which may be primarily touch or primarily sound, but that it always exists mm-hmm. connected to other senses, and with also the potential for action in terms of, there's a lot of ecological psychology work about perception and action as always being linked. So that was my kind of almost rereading of that section, that, you know, mm-hmm. sensing is always,
I think it always is. I don't know whether perhaps in this case it's heightened your awareness of that. I don't know. I mean, because I would agree with you, I think that is always the case, but I think there is something that,
yeah.
particularly with that thing of the relationship with the shadows, so you are perhaps more aware of that. And
is that because of a negation, though? Because of the lack of a
possibly.
Direct...
I think possibly it is, yeah.
To go back to the tactility
yeah.
thing earlier.
I think possibly that is the case.
Well, I think it's sort of a brilliant insight in some way. Because there are, you know, I think there are big differences between the details of how you engage. So, I mean, of course, I suppose it's true, definitely it would be true to say that things are multimodal, your senses are always multimodal, but there are ways that we use them which have got long histories of kind of cultural, different kind of cultural values. And
I think you put that very nicely a bit later, actually, and also I like this section again very much for some reasons.
I think it looks a bit vague now afterwards, because what I wish to continue would be the, yeah, perhaps, but what is the particular way of sensing these plural senses and relations between senses, which comes particularly from the Ouija environment and this combination, and of yours contribution, yours as musicians, persons, and this kind of, and what would be this kind of joint sensing in a way? That would be the one question. This is kind of introductory comment, I think, now, what a person only self-critical, but yeah. Because, yeah, what's the point? Yeah, they are, of course, senses. But what then?
How does it function in a specific context of this?
Yeah, yeah. What would Ouija bring to this?
I think you come on to that question, though, because you then talk about, there's a contrast with this tactility of the, and you talk about the flute, and this, which we'll come on to. And then I think a bit later you get onto that with the electroacoustic processes, that there is a sort of contrastive thing.
I mean, I feel in the whole context of what I hope that Ouija thing might be enabling, the fact that it built into it is this process of referral, and so that you aren't looking at your actual hand, you're looking at the shadow of it, and that the shadow of it is the kind of the object.
That assumes that the looking is the primary part here, though, isn't it?
Well, it's almost, it's like...
But
it's
the looking is touching.
Precisely, it's replacing, in some sense, the function of one sense with the... I mean, I have...
There's a kind of synesthesia, or...
Exactly, and that there's something almost conscious, well, not simply, almost the opposite, but that it's precisely that you're using your sight in order to hear. The kind of tactile thing with instruments is very direct. You can almost feel that your body is kind of blending with the instrument and the sound, and quite often it's touching you, it's vibrating with you. It's all about somehow...
Is it something that you are adapting the instrumentality of the Ouija of your kind of
alienation,
kind of sensing mechanisms?
I was going in a different direction, which was satisfying me for an odd reason. That because it comes to a later point you made, that, mm-hmm. that so acoustic instruments, that it's as if you build up a sense of self which kind of radiates out into the world and then you listen back to it in some way. Whilst with this system of looking at your shadow, you've got a distance from the object which is
mm-hmm.
absolutely fundamental in what you look at. So the object is already your shadow. You're not looking at your hand and you're not looking at the instrument itself, as is the case with, you know, theremins or, you know, magneto-optic whatnots. You know, it's always either the instrument or your body. In this case, it's an image of yourself and it's not yourself. So immediately...
In what sense is it not yourself?
Eh?
In what sense is it not yourself?
I think there's a difference between focusing on your shadow and focusing on your hand.
I still don't know that I buy that. I wonder if that, yes, you do consciously focus, of course you do, on your hand and the shadow, but there's all this other, saying all this stuff about kinesthetic, there's all sorts of other things that it's not just looking, is it? I thought that's what I was taking from this earlier section.
No, it's not, no, absolutely.
This polymodality is actually really important. It isn't actually about looking. It is, looking's...
But it's where you're, it's the idea that actually what the Ouija plane is suggesting is that you have to take in everything. You know, by not saying it begins with my hand or it begins with the muscles in my arm, but it begins with the distance of the thing from myself. It means that what you're listening to is the whole situation. You're listening to the sounds in the room, the potentials in the recordings. It's somehow, it's just putting that alienation, or alienation is, you know, possible, but putting that distance, or is renvoi, is that a word that comes up, like, you know, renvoi, I feel that's comes like the
I quite like that, it's almost making manifest, or making kind of embodying something which is not
exactly, and it's not disembodiment, but it's looking at a fundamental.
But alienation from what?
Well, it's not alienation. Alienation is
the
wrong
word,
but it's like it's not negative disassociation. It's disassociation in a positive sort of sense. That it's looking at your image.
But did you just say that it's not your shadow when it's the shadow of your hand? But did you just say that it's not your shadow? I mean.
No, it's your shadow. Yeah, no, I didn't. I don't think I meant to say.
Uh-huh, okay.
It's not, but it's just that the idea that somehow it's not the process of connecting to the outside world by saying that everything comes from my direct actions on it leads to one way of linking your senses together.
But you're still mapping. I mean, I'm sorry to be probably kind of reductive about it, but you're still mapping. You're trying to map a certain kind of patternicity. You know, from a kind of interactional point of view, you're trying to negotiate a sense in which something that you do causes something else somewhere else at the simplest level. So even, you know, whether that's visual or tactile or whatever, in some sense, presumably what matters is that in some sense there's a legibility about what you do and what happens. Why am I saying this? It's something to do with... I wonder if it really is different. I mean, we've identified that there are differences. Clearly, there are differences around, say, the tactility of the instrument, and there are clearly differences in terms of ownership and how many people could interact with the space and whatnot. But I wonder if there might be something about emphasising some of the commonalities with other ideas of instruments, actually, like the idea that, you know, when you explore any instrument, one of the things you're trying to do is you bash away at it in whatever form, is to sort of go, oh, I do that and it does that. You know, you're looking for some sort of correspondences of some sort, no matter, and sometimes they're highly refined and very predictable, but other times they're not. But I don't know if, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what I'm saying, Ray. Shut up. I don't know.
But I like that. I mean,
Something about emphasising the visuality that I'm finding a little
but
bit.
But is it not something also about the space? The space between the idea of, I don't know I'm if this is what we're getting at all, but when you, the extension of yourself to the instrument and the physical link you have with that is quite direct and there's no separation. But somehow with the Ouija there is
there's
something kind of and the shadow is the manifestation of that space and it's a visualization of that space, but it's
that feels very good. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that's very much how I experience it.
Exactly.
And
it's not only a visualization of yourself, but it's a visualization
of
your distance.
Yes.
But
does actually affect your relationship with hate and this thing.
But I'm thinking about your ideas earlier about the attack on the enlightenment. And what I think we're talking about are extramissive theories of perception. I don't know if people have come across those. Theories of extramission. Before the before, if you like, current paradigms in terms of perception, it was believed pre-enlightenment that in order to see something, we projected from our eyes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So you know, it's not that light is reflected from things and then we perceive it. We project something out from ourselves, and that kind of illuminates and creates the world around us. And I'm wondering if there's a similar thing happening here. Like, I mean, in a literal sense, the light, you know, the hand is projecting a shadow. Which is being read by it. So there's kind of an idea that something is actually emanating from the body, or so emanating from the hand, which is somehow touching a sound in some way. I don't know why it's relevant. There was an association there. I felt there was some kind of implication of extramissiveness. So whether it's visual or whether
it's
tactile,
I suppose that what is the thing onto which your shadow is falling, and that there is this offering of it being an unmarked space, that it's one which is ready to be colonized or territorial, you know, that it's being, it can be made into territory in all sorts of ways, but it suggests that it isn't, and that your shadow is a way of making a completely sort of, as it were, transitory trace on this thing, and that you see that, you know, in a way it's sort of almost like, well, ownership of the instrument as well. It's not, you know, it's not your instrument, it's not my instrument, though that could be another issue.
By the way, now I started to think that it's interesting because it's hands that we have, because I think we have some specific relation to our hands and the instrumentality of those.
Tool.
But what, for example, if the shadows...
Well, it's a Jimi Hendrix approach to...
if the shadows are made by, I mean, moving the whole
body
for example,
legs. Essentially, would it make a difference? I don't know if it... Would it not? I don't know. I mean, obviously it would be a different experience for you.
It would, in that you... There is a sense in which... I mean, I don't know how it could work like that. I think it would be very difficult...
Well, think about
that's saying it's like there's the hands thing enhances kind of emphasizes that thing of the space and the distance
and the contained space that you're talking about.
If it was your body, I mean, partly my thing is like, how on earth could that work with the instrument as it stands? It would be a completely different instrument in terms of how it has to work. But
anything could cast a shadow over the... It wouldn't have to be a body, it could be a piece of paper.
You can. Initially we did do it with pieces of paper,
didn't we?
Okay. So, which was different.
Very.
She reminds me also of conversations we had about...
And touching, because we did actually put them on the table, we put things down.
But also projecting. There was a conversation at one point about creating potential, almost like theatrical shapes and things that could be projected and moved and changed. Using, you know, other ways of producing shadow.
Well, I definitely feel that the visual metaphors are being quite tightly controlled the way that the visual metaphors are disseminated through the space that and through our heads. You know, that the light falls on the table and that light bounces back and lights up our faces and the lights up other people in the room, kind of by the light bouncing off. It's not even the initial spotlight that lights everyone up. There's this cascade of symbolic kind of...
It's a bit like the whole thing about the glance, isn't it? The glance being reflected.
Exactly.
The way that that's bounced
also
around.
That the hand refers mostly to touching.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, the hand could touch.
And yet it doesn't.
Yeah.
I'm in your paragraph here, you know, I know that there's an awful lot about the differences between art criticism, visual art criticism, and...
We talked about this, didn't we? Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And sound art, the differences, the kind of different critical perspective that one has about images compared to sound.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And obviously this discussion moves
between the two.
those two kind of critical
perspectives. I was very interested to hear that Jean-Luc Nancy had written this book about listening, because I'd never, I hadn't come across it. But
it's a nice tiny book, very beautiful book.
And I think about him as occupying a different, not a sound art space, but you know, something else. So it's quite exactly. It sits in between this.
Mm. And I think that's why it's got a very sort of interesting sort of resonances.
Mm. Because of the visuality of the region, etc. Yeah, that's true. Should we move on?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just aware that there's...
I mean, should we have a break at some point?
Yeah,
never.
Perhaps we should
have. No.
At some point we have to go to supper because...
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
So I reckon it looks like we're not going to actually play.
No.